Welcome to Step Into Magic, your weekly online radio show on how to develop your psychic ability, deepen your spirituality, and find your own true purpose, with acclaimed medical intuitive, Josephine Lang. This broadcast is a part of the Wisdom and Intuition Network at worldclasswind.com. This is Tony Taylor, your host, and on behalf of Josephine, I'll be taking your calls and questions. This week's topic is Myths, Archetypes, and Daydreams Guide Us on Our Journey. For anyone new to our show, Josephine has been a clairvoyant healer for more than 25 years. During that time, she has helped thousands of people from around the world to heal from hard-to-diagnose and chronic health issues. She's also been a teacher and spiritual mentor for hundreds of people who treasure her insights, courage, and love.
Hello, everyone, and thanks so much for listening. I'd really like to welcome our new listeners in France and in India and Germany and the Netherlands, South Africa and Italy, and welcome back to all of you who are regular listeners around the world. And it's such a pleasure to have you all joining us tonight. It just warms my heart no end. So welcome, welcome. And, you know, together we are forming a community that is helping to open the mind of humanity across the world. So it's a really wonderful thing, and we're all joining in on this and actively participating. So I'm very grateful to all of you. And what we're doing is we're leaving behind the old paradigms of fear and domination, and we're really making positive strides towards reclaiming our human qualities of love and seeing the sacred in everything. And this inner journey that we're all on together, it can be, you know, it can really include a few distractions and some temptations and even some fears that can arise from time to time to sway us from the course. But deep within us, we know the life that we are meant to live. And when we pay attention, our love and our joy will unerringly lead us to it. And Joseph Campbell put it so beautifully. He said, follow your bliss. And what I like to say is, stay in your joy. And Peace Pilgrim, another one of my wonderful favorite mentors, she would say, finding your calling is what we want to do in our lives. And so it's all about all of this, be it bliss or joy or our calling. It's all about choosing to love ourselves enough to let us ourselves do what we love. And if we're not sure how to go about that, well, then working with myths and archetypes and daydreams can further help us to find our way. And by exploring the self and using the experiences of our lives, you know, for our growth and development, we find that we can uncover our unique path in the world. And this allows us to share with the world the one thing that only we can give. But before we go into this topic any further, I always like to begin our show with our spiritual agreement. And this was a gift to me from our friend and mentor, Jana Massey, and I'd like to ask you all to join with me right now in making this agreement together. And it goes like this. Together we acknowledge that everything that we think, that we say, and that we do at this time will be of the highest good. And together we ask for truth, the understanding of that truth, and the wisdom to use it in our lives. Do you all agree?
I do.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you, everyone, so much, and me too. I agree as well. So I'd like to start off tonight with one of my favorite quotes on finding our purpose in life, and it really is like a hero's journey because we have to choose and then give ourselves over to the passion and the energy of our lives. And once we do this, we find that we've entered into the flow of something that can often be much greater than we anticipated. And I think that Mahatma Gandhi said it so beautifully. He said, God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. And when a person thus loses themselves, that person immediately finds themselves in the service of all that lives. Such service becomes their delight and recreation. They become a new person, never weary of spending themselves in the service of God's creation, which is kind of like thy will be done, or thy will be my will. And, you know, good quotes are often read twice. I wonder, Tony, if you would mind reading that again for our listeners. Such a beauty.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. And when a person thus loses themselves, that person immediately finds themselves in the service of all that lives. Such service becomes their delight and recreation. They become a new person, never weary of spending themselves in the service of God's creation.
Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
It's so great. And this delight, you know, this abounding energy that is found in our true service, it doesn't come overnight. I mean, there can often be obstacles on the course, but once we attain it, we are truly in our truth, and the energy just flows. As Peace Pilgrim said, energy just flows through me like electricity flows through a wire. And I think it's really true. You know, the great scholars and the people who have really found their truth in life, they are just tireless, and they just go and go and go, and they just love their work, and it thrills them no end. And that's the way it is for me. I feel so blessed. I feel just so thrilled in my work. It's just such a joy. It's what I want to do, first thing when I get up and the last thing in the night. And that's the way our work is meant to be. Our work is meant to be a real blessing for us and for everyone else. And I'm sure many of you have had that experience as well, where you just get lost in what you're loving and doing. And, you know, another version of this is the hero's journey. This is you know, there's that beautiful book by Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And in this particular type of scenario, you know, the person is leading a sort of a day-to-day type life, and then there is some sort of a wake-up call that happens, some sort of a yearning or a deep need, and there may even be a reluctance to go for it. You know, we may have to be a little bit sort of drug-kicking and screaming sometimes into our purpose, but that's okay. And this is not always the case for everybody, but for some people on our purpose, it's like this a little bit. And that, you know, kind of that feeling of, you know, getting really pushed into it a little bit can happen sometimes, and that can sometimes result in a feeling of being separated from others. And, you know, perhaps if this is sort of true for you, you can think back and kind of relive your life a little bit here with these ideas in mind, you know, that day-to-day life, and then there's the wake-up call and some sort of a yearning or something has happened, and then we kind of get kicked into it a little bit. And, like, for instance, in my own case, I had that, you know, 10 years of major injuries, and a couple of different times I had to spend a year in bed. It was pretty profound, and it was through that time that my empathy began to arise, where I would begin to feel what was going on in the physical bodies of others. And that's how I became a medical intuitive. It sort of caught me by surprise. It wasn't anything that I had planned on doing. I was actually kind of happily being a gardener, sort of living that day-to-day life. And then there I was, all of a sudden moving into it. And there was a little bit of reluctance on my part, just because I didn't know how to grapple with that, feeling the pain of other people. You know, if I was standing in line at a grocery store or something, standing next to somebody, suddenly I'd have a bad headache or change lines and there'd be sort of some low back pain. And I thought, what's going on here? You know, and it can even be a little frightening sometimes for us. But the good news is that when we get really started on this journey, you know, because sometimes, you know, you never know what the cause might be. You know, maybe there's a death or a loss of a job, or often it's something really big like that really shakes up our world. And but the good news is that at around the same time, doors start to open. You know, Joseph Campbell says, doors will open for you where there would not even be a door for someone else. And then, of course, often what happens is the hero, in this case the hero's journey, meets a mentor and gets some sage advice. And in my case, I was sort of brought into the inner sanctum of Dr. Otto's office during his off hours to begin working as a psychic, as a clairvoyant healer. It was something I never planned on doing, but it was wonderful, and I loved it, and I couldn't wait to go in and work, and I would just wait for his calls. It was really quite an extraordinary experience. And there then, of course, as well, we need to confront our fears. There's usually something that'll come up, and there's no turning back. You're like, you're in it. You're going down the path of your life at who knows what speed, and tests will come, and allies will come, and enemies will come. Like, for instance, for me, I had this one, you know, situation that would come up where I would be working on somebody and suddenly I'd feel like I had caught their condition. as suddenly it was beginning to manifest in my own body, and I'd think, ay, 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 and I called that crossing over. And I later, as I worked with it more and more, I learned that it wasn't actually that I had caught that condition. It was that that condition was latent in me, and it was a little tiny baby version of it. And by working on that other person, it brought it to my own awareness and my own attention so that I could then go ahead and heal my own body. So it wasn't at all catching it. It was just bringing it to my attention. So these kind of interesting things can happen. In my case also, too, there was the whole illegality problem, because until 2007, you know, there wasn't really a legal format for people to do healing of this nature. The healing was confined to medical doctors and chiropractors, and in some cases, doctors of Chinese medicine. But then in 2007, laws were passed that made it legal, and in the meanwhile, before that, I had become a minister so that I could go ahead and continue with my healing work. So, you know, these sorts of, I'm just sharing these with you because they are sort of examples of those tests or those stumbling blocks or things that come up that can cause us to confront our fears. But really, you know, and there is sort of a death. There's the person seems to die through this process, but really it's not, it's only our former self that dies. And we find that opportunities come and synchronicities will arise that will guide us on our path. And this is where it's sort of, you know, in the hero's journey, it's where the hero seizes the sword and slays the dragon. And what happens is we are completely changed by the experience, and a new self is born. And, you know, we've overcome the obstacles, and we claim the gold. You know, dragons are always guarding gold in these myths. And so we claim that gold, and then we're free to return back to our community to share whatever it is that we have gained. And then there's a freedom that comes to the life that comes from this type of service. And I love that, what Gandhi's line, you know, God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. And when a person thus loses themselves, that person immediately finds themselves in the service of all that lives. And such service becomes their delight and recreation. They become a new person, never weary of spending themselves in the service of God's creation. And I really think that that is that poem and the whole story of the hero's journey, they just go so hand in hand, because we really are free then to return and to share, and there is a freedom that comes from that service. So these stories are very valuable to us, because they help us to not feel so all alone. And there's a comfort that comes to us when we hear about other people's challenges and their failures and their successes. We see, it lets us see how, for our own selves, how there are possibilities for how we can navigate those changing waters on our own. So maybe you can show our next slide then, Tony, if you would.
Certainly, I'd love to.
Great. And this is a quote from Joseph Campbell. And he says, "We must let go of the life we have planned so as to accept the one that is waiting for us." And it's so true. I had planned to be a gardener. Oh, well. Sometimes you just have to let go and accept the life that's waiting for you.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yes, I can just, that's such an inspiring thought, isn't it? But so it's very challenging as well to let go of, you know, if you're in a life that is planned, and just to let that go. Because to accept the one that is waiting for us, it's kind of like, it sounds like a great big leap into the unknown.
It is, and I often think of parents, you know, people who have children, suddenly, oh my gosh, they're leaping into the great unknown. Now that's a hero's journey.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And then, you know, when you get to the stage that I'm at now, when my son is now 18, so probably leaving home
yes.
in a not too distant future, and there's a big step out in the unknown for him, which I guess as a parent is also a step into the unknown for you too.
Yes, absolutely. Mm.
But yes, I mean, I can see that with the description of the hero's journey, that's probably all of us in our own little hero's journey with the call to action and facing the challenges and the struggles and then the fears and, you know, finally, you know, overcoming the obstacles and then being able to enjoy some of the rewards.
Yeah, and that reluctance is in there too, you know.
Yeah, it's all there.
It's all there. Yeah. One of my favorite mentors, Peace Pilgrim, speaks about her many preparations for an authentic life. And one of them is that we must get down below the surface of life, down to where it's real. And she says that so many people are surface livers. rarely reaching down into what is truly meaningful to us. And it's true. So often, you know, we find ourselves succumbing to indulgences which parade falsely as fulfillments, or there are illusions of gratification that lure us away from our true self, and then distractions that, you know, promise to free us from boredom. And Sam Keen says, he's a wonderful writer for men's spirituality, he says that in our modern society, with its emphasis on advertising, he says that so often we are given the answers without ever having taken the time to ask the questions. And I think that's such a great thought, because it does happen like that. We're suddenly, you know, here, this is what you want. Oh, okay, you know, without really thinking, what do I really want? Instead, we're just here, take this, here, this is what you, you know. And we want to really think about what it is that we personally would like. And meanwhile, while we're getting, you know, lured by distractions or succumbing to indulgences, our precious life is just slipping away from us. And time is, you know, our lives here are so precious and sacred and wonderful. And every day is a miracle, every moment. And as my mentor and teacher, Jana Massey, used to say, and that the teachers warned, you know, sometimes if we do wake up, we risk falling back to sleep. So, you know, we need to find our own shimmering light, the one that belongs to us alone, and to follow it. And then we can use that light to help illuminate the path for others. And we have that beautiful slide from Martha Graham. Tony, maybe you could read that out for us.
Certainly, I'd love to. Okay, it goes like this. There is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, and to keep the channel open.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it's so inspiring, and sometimes I have it going through my mind, because I've been aware of this quote for a long time.
Me too.
And occasionally, I feel a little guilty when I have these thoughts going through my mind. I'm left thinking, oh, but look what I'm doing with my time today, and I'm not keeping the channel open. Do you have any suggestions for what I could do with that, Josephine, when I get those kind of thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important to not judge ourself and our calling, and sometimes our calling can be slipping up on us when we don't even really realize it. You know, there was that wonderful story that you told a few weeks ago about the burglar who was kind of a lousy burglar.
Oh, yes.
And he wound up doing time in jail, and then he, you know, finally got out and got a job and worked really hard at it and got asked to come back and came back another day, and then he was asked if he could do a different job, and he didn't really know how to do that, but he said, oh, sure, and he did that job for a while, and then he got asked to head that foundation for people who were coming out of prison, who were looking for work, and people who had been made redundant in that situation, and he was heading that nonprofit, and here he had inadvertently, you know, sort of found his way right into his true calling, and it took a number of steps that didn't really seem like the right thing. And I think that that's really what happens, is that sometimes we get a little, you know, over anxious that, you know, maybe I'm not doing the right thing, but I actually think we can trust ourselves that all of it is a part of what leads us to our true purpose in a way. So I guess the main thrust of the point is that, you know, we want to just let ourselves do what we truly would love to do, at least in part.
I know, and sometimes I think I struggle with that, and I'm almost kind of like answering my own question, because I'm thinking, what would Josephine say? She'd probably say, well, that's a self-love issue. You know?
And I would, and that was just where I was going to go next.
Okay, well, good, then tell me that's a start, because I'm still not looking in the mirror every morning and saying I love you.
Oh, well, time to get started on that one.
I know.
Yeah, we want to let our hearts guide us into our unique growth, you know, and there are obstacles, and this is clearly one of those obstacles here, you know, mm-hmm. that being able to love yourself enough to look in the mirror and say, I love you, I truly love you, just exactly the way you are. One of the most important exercises we can do. It's really great.
You.
You're welcome. So Georgia O'Keeffe, oh my God, what an amazing artist, huh? It's just beautiful. Oh my goddess, maybe I should say. It's just so extraordinary. Her colors and her palette, you know, is just really, really phenomenal. And then when Frank and I were growing up, his sister was dancing in the Bela Lewitsky Dance Company. She was a modern dancer, just an amazing modern dancer and a real champion for the arts. And both of those women really influenced me in my younger years, and they still do to this day, because they were not exactly what I would call highly social. You know, they were really true to their artistic vision. And, you know, they might have been criticized for not being acquiescent because they were not the kind of women who would, you know, compromise their values or their standards. And especially with Georgia O'Keeffe, who sought a lot of quiet time and time to really honor herself and her painting in her later years especially. And so I think it's important to mention, and I think it's especially important for women, since we've all been conditioned since childhood to be subservient and to say yes to whatever is asked of us. And, you know, there's that popular slogan now, just say no. Well, I kind of think we women could use to embrace that a little bit, to just be aware that, you know, sometimes, you know, we women need to learn how to do that and, you know, to just learn how to say no. So, like, for instance, because our generation was so conditioned into that, and we still need improvement. I mean, my mother's generation was completely in that mindset where whatever, you know, of being the subservient woman. Even though my mother was a strong woman, she still, you know, would yield all the time to the requests of others. And in a way, I think that's part of how she lost her life so young and so early. So I had to learn this, too, because I am my mother's daughter, and I found myself, you know, some 20 years ago when people would say, gee, Josephine, you know, can you do this? I would just immediately say, oh, sure, you know, yeah, sure, yeah, you know. And we do have to learn how to pay attention to our own inner self. And sometimes I would find myself on the telephone saying yes to something while my stomach and my guts were just churning, going, oh, I can't possibly. And so I made myself a little cue card that I put on the bottom of the telephone so that I could look at it to see. And there I put some little tips on there, for instance, like, oh, we've got a lot of things going on right now. You know, what did you have in mind? Or, I can't commit just at the moment. Let me get back to you on all of this. Or different things like that, you know, so that it would just give me some time to process and to find some sort of appropriate loving kindness words that I could use to decline or to get advice, you know, to find out what I should do. And maybe you can show that next slide then, Tony. This is, again, from Jana and Massey and the teachers,
yes,
my mentor. This one says, only that which is mine to do, no more, no less. And that's such a nice affirmation, and it's one that I like to use. You know, only that which is mine to do, no more, no less. It's really that from this place of good boundaries, you know, really holding our boundaries, like what Georgia O'Keeffe and Bela Lewitsky had, that we can enter into the boundlessness, that we can really go into that boundless quality, that place of greater service in a life that is lived for more than just ourselves. But we have to have that boundary first, that sort of firm footing before we can really fly.
So, Josephine, let me ask you just a very brief question about that. So, with the thought, only that which is mine to do, no more, no less, is there like an inner asking, is this mine to do? Is
yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Is this mine to do is exactly the question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and the place that we want to ask, of course, is the heart. That's where we want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And they've, you know, found recently that when people are given images to look at, randomly selected, that the heart knows before the image is shown what the reaction is going to be. There's like a several seconds before. So here's these random images that are coming up. Maybe one is a sunset. Maybe one is of a little puppy dog. And then there's some that are more distressing, like maybe the scene of a car accident or something like that. And the person is going to be looking at these images and responding to them. And the heart knows before the image is shown what the emotional response is going to be. And then the image comes on. And they found this out by hooking up electrodes to people's hearts and things. And then the response comes from first the heart up to the brain and then down to the gut. And that gut reaction that we have is actually often a heart response. And so that feeling that I was talking about of that, you know, where my guts were just kind of going, oh, no, it was because my heart wasn't into it. It was not my calling. And it was something that would have been a distraction, that would have taken me away from where my true energies would like to go. And, you know, we are so often influenced by other people who want us to do things that maybe aren't really our true self. And that's okay. It's wonderful that they try to do. They always have, you know, most always have our best interests at heart, but we just want to pay attention to what our hearts are saying about it.
Thank you so much for that, Josephine.
You're welcome. Good question. That is the place to ask, though. We do want to ask, is this mine? And we want to ask our hearts. So now I'd like to talk just a little bit about the basic archetypes that we have. So we've mentioned the hero, which, you know, includes the adversary. That's another archetype. And there are some, you know, this wonderful book that Frank has, which is King, Warrior, Magician, Lover. It's by Robert Moore and Douglas Gillette. And, you know, it speaks about those are some primary archetypes for men, you know, the king, the warrior, the magician, the lover, and kind of taking a look at where you might fit in that picture or what blend of those do you have or all of them. And then I love, for women, The Goddesses in Every Woman, Jean Shinoda Bolen, amazing book. And she also has one, The Goddesses in Older Women, for archetypes, you know, in women over 50. And here we come across all of these beautiful goddess images and ideas, like, you know, the virgin goddesses of Artemis or Athena or Hestia, or, you know, the mother goddesses of Demeter, or, you know, some of these others, like Persephone would be the maiden for Demeter, or Athena, which is the goddess of wisdom and craft. She would be another mother goddess. Sophia is another great image of the goddess. So, you know, we can kind of find how we fit into these ideas. So those would be examples of the archetype of the mother or the great mother or Mother Earth. Gaia is another wonderful archetype that we can align with and feel within ourselves. Then there's, you know, the father archetype, which could be the sun or the sky god or the masculine versions of the divine. Or the mentor is another archetype that we might find ourselves in, or the student, the learner, or the innocent. That's a wonderful archetype. The innocent is often associated with the fool and is sort of blessed and can travel through life without having too many scrapes and difficulties because they just so innocently travel along.
Mm.
So there's a lot of these different sort of archetypes. And then there's also the myths, those very familiar, like the Greek pantheon of the gods and goddesses. I was mentioning some of those, Artemis and Hestia and Zeus with his lightning rod and his discipline. And then there are the Roman counterparts like Diana and Vesta and Jupiter, just to name a few.
Well, as it happens, Josephine, I do know quite a bit about the Greek pantheon and their Roman counterparts, just by chance. When I was much younger, I studied them for ages with my friend Sonia.
Oh.
And we started out reading Robert Graves' book, The Greek Gods. It's a fine book, simple introduction to all the important Greek myths. And it's just really, really fascinating if you look at them from a psychological point of view. So, for example, Hermes is often viewed as a trickster god, and he's known as Mercury to the Romans. And then Aphrodite, one of the most famous of all, the goddess of love and sexual desire, Venus for the Romans. And then one that we were particularly interested in was Dionysus, the god of wine and pleasure and abandon, known as Bacchus to the Romans. I don't know why we were so interested in Dionysus, but we were.
It might have had something to do with your age. You were probably in your 20s, were you?
Yeah, 21, something like
that.
Yeah,
that's perfect thing to be interested in. Right time in your life.
But I really did feel in studying those myths, I was getting kind of like an insight into, you know, patterns in me and in life, and it was very rewarding.
Yeah, well, that's great. So then we also have, you know, the queen or the princess. We have a cat who very much fits in the princess archetype. And then we also have a cat that fits in the queen archetype.
Yes.
And then there's the spy and the fool and the trickster and the magician, like I mentioned, or the saboteur. That's one kind of to pay attention to and watch out for. Or the one who has the Midas touch, or the opposite of that, the biblical Job idea, or the martyr or the dragon slayer. And sometimes, you know, we can enter into the river of these archetypes and myths, these images or ways of being in the world. They can almost pull us along and influence us. And I almost feel that sometimes they can grab a hold of our lives. You know, for example, we can get caught up in being the teacher. That's one that I've gotten caught up in a time or two, or the grump or the Grinch, you know. So we just want to be aware, because if we let them, they can either lend a helpful energy to our venture, or they can limit us a little bit by holding us to an energy pattern that might not be quite the right fit for us. So we just want to pay attention, because these are large flows of energy that can kind of come our way, and we can sort of get caught up in them like a river flowing by. And then also, we're all very telepathic. We may not realize it, but we actually really are. And my dear friend, Rupert Sheldrake, I just noticed that he's doing a new test that, you know, he likes to do these large groups of people that will join in on tests, and it's the attention test. And it's where you dial in, and you can go to his website, rupertsheldrake.org, I believe it is, and then look for the just attention, you know, test there, and see if, you know, you pair up with someone, and you'll find out if you're aware of when you're both looking at the same picture, or if you're both listening to the same music. And that happens. We can really pick up. I mean, sometimes I'm with Frank, and, you know, and Frank and I will be thinking the same thought, and we'll say something, I was just thinking of that. And I'm sure you guys, or you are, to all of our listeners, you've had experiences like that, too, with somebody that you're really close with, maybe a spouse or a child. And suddenly you're like, well, now who thought of that first? So we are all a little bit telepathic, and we can pick up, you know, not only these group mind patterns like archetypes, but we can also pick up the thoughts of others. And it's important for us to remember to at least occasionally dust off the desktop of our minds by taking a little time during the day to use our intention and consciously clear other people's thoughts out of our heads. So I do this by imagining a small, bright, white light right inside the center of my head. And I let it begin to expand to fill up my whole head, and then just a little bit beyond the space of my head. So let's go ahead and try to do this together right now as a little exercise. It's a very simple one. You can do it with eyes opened. And so as I do it, I imagine that this light has just pushed out all the thoughts of others. And I say to myself, there is only room for my own thoughts inside my head. So let's do it now. So just imagine a little light inside of your head, a little bright white light. And then let that light begin to grow and expand. And let it fill your entire head, and then move just a little bit beyond. And now say to yourself, there is only room for my own thoughts inside my head. And then go ahead and return to your normal waking consciousness, because we've just been a little bit inside of ourselves. And, you know, let's have this exercise as our homework assignment this week. Let's try to do it at least once a day, and preferably several times a day, to just take a moment to imagine this beautiful white light expanding in your head and acknowledging that it's clearing out all the thoughts of others, and then affirm. And maybe you can put that slide on for us, Tony.
Certainly.
There is only room for my own thoughts inside my head. And thank you, Frank, so much for these beautiful slides. And, you know, doing something like this, pushing out all the thoughts of others, this allows us to create greater potential to choose a life of our own creation. And so, yeah, and thanks, Frank. These slides are wonderful that you make all the time. And, oh, and I wanted to mention, I've just taken a sip of this. Frank makes these beautiful probiotic sodas now, and I've never been a soda pop fan, but boy, am I a soda fan now, because they are probiotic. They're loaded with not injected carbon dioxide into them. It's actually beneficial bacteria that has grown, that has created the fizzy part. And they're delicious because they have no sugar in them. Frank's been making them with fruit juices or ginger tea, with a little bit of apple juice maybe in it or something like that. That's a sugar that the probiotic can eat up. And so the sweetness is all gone, but the flavor is still there. It's really wonderful, and they're so good for you. They just help to reinstall that beneficial bacteria throughout our gut tracts. And I've just been loving them. So if you're interested at all, and if you live locally, our friend Virginia at Vert Foods, Vert is green in French, it's V-E-R-T, Vert Foods has been really changing the lives of lots of people in our area and changing our lives, certainly. And she explained that not too long ago she was watching a Jimmy Stewart movie, and it was an early one from like the 20s or 30s or something. I'm not sure. Well, maybe not that. I'm not good with my dates. But in any case, in the scene, he had had a night out where he had done too much indulging in too much food and alcohol, and he asked his friend to go get him a probiotic soda. And, you know, that's, it was like, oh, my God, what an image and what an idea, you know. So people used to do this all the time. And soda pops originally were actually something that was quite healthy for you. They were made with good medicinal herbs and roots that were good, like sarsaparilla and, you know, ginger and things like that that were beneficial to us. And then with the probiotics in there, they're just great for you. So I couldn't help but saying it, because Frank has really taken it on as a hobby lately, and it's just so wonderful. So thank you, my darling.
And I've been fortunate enough to try some of them as well, and I can certainly attest to how tasty they are. They're absolutely delicious.
Yes, they are. And weren't you likening them the other day to a particular type of beer?
Yes, I had one the other day, and it really reminded me of these really strong Belgian beers that I once tried. They were, you know, very fruity, and, well, it was very nice. But anyway, getting back to the exercise, that felt very, very nice to me. I'd never tried that. It's a little strange at first to imagine where the center of your head is.
Yes.
And to actually imagine a light there. But I always imagined that part of my head, I guess, the very center was very dark. I never really thought of there being a light there. I'm not sure I've ever thought particularly what is there.
Yeah.
But it was very calming, and it did feel very nice to think that, you know, only my thoughts. It felt like, and you said about doing that every day, many times a day. I think that would be a really good idea for me, and I'm sure it would be a very good idea for everyone listening, too.
Great. Good. Good. Yeah. I love these little homework assignments. I do them, too.
Mm.
So we were just talking about the strong influences of other people in our lives. And, you know, as well-intentioned as others are, you know, they're usually our loved ones, as I was sort of alluding to, their primary concern is typically for our safety. It's very sweet, really. And they love us, and they want to keep us around. So they don't want us to take any risks or really go off the deep end on anything. And this is especially the case with our parents, you know, who've been trying to keep us alive ever since we were born. And I love that story that Ram Dass tells from when he was a young man and he was setting out on his path in life. And he said that his parents made it abundantly clear to him that they wanted him to be well-educated and to achieve and to be responsible, and to stay healthy, and to be successful, and to bring pride to them. And if he had first accomplished all of this, then he could seek his own happiness. Isn't that just so typical? But, you know, this is not a recipe for an authentic life. You know, this is a life lived according to the plans of others. And there's that best-selling book that, you know, got picked up by Hay House by Bronnie Ware, and it's called The Top Five Regrets of the Dying, A Life Transformed by the Dearly Departing. And she's an Australian woman, and she worked as a nurse doing palliative care, you know, that's helping to make people comfortable for the folks who were dying. And she decided to record her patients' epiphanies during the last 12 weeks of their lives. And she found that the number one deathbed regret among them was that they had wished that they had had the courage to live a life that was true to themselves rather than the life that others expected of them.
That's a really powerful thought, isn't it?
Isn't it? So poignant, isn't
it?
Yeah,
so it's a wake-up call, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It's a big wake-up call.
Did she mention any other regrets apart from that, I wonder?
Yeah, she did. They said that they wished that they hadn't worked so hard.
Oh.
And they said that they wished that they'd had the courage to express their feelings. And I think so often we don't say what we really need to say. It's so important for us to tell others how we feel and to love others whenever we can and as best we can, and to choose love, as Michael Rhodes says, as often as we can. So it's, yeah, I wish I hadn't worked so hard, and I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. And let's see, it was, oh, yes, to wish they would have stayed in touch with their friends, And it's so true, you know, sometimes we just let our friendships slip away, and even if they're really, really good ones. And, you know, there's that Rumi quote, you know, be with those who help your being. And sometimes our really good friends like that, you know, they really help us to be who we are, and it's important to spend time with them. And then I think the last one was that they wished to let themselves be happier. And that's a big one too, isn't it? You know, to let ourselves take the time to be happy.
Oh, it's huge, yeah.
Yeah. So let's do another little exercise, shall we?
Good. Yes.
And this is one that will help us to stay true to ourselves and true to our own unique vision for our lives. And so this one you can do with open eyes. And just think back over your day today. And as I mentioned, you know, we're all telepathic and we often receive the thoughts of others. And just see if you can remember a time today when there was a thought that you had that might not have been your own. It may have come from somebody else. It probably would be somebody who you know and love and who loves you. And maybe there's an image associated with the thought. You know, perhaps somebody thought of you archetypically, like a teacher or a warrior or a magician or the great mother. Maybe they see you, you know, as being one of those. Or maybe they see you as sabotaging yourself. You know, we can kind of almost hear those voices inside our heads sometimes of other people talking to us. No matter, you know. Just realize that the thoughts of others enter into our sphere of awareness all the time. And we can either accept them or we can let them go as we choose. And these thoughts and archetypal images, they tend to collect in what my teacher and mentor Jana referred to as the psychic collar. And we clean our psychic collar every time we get into the shower. Or we can clean it any time of the day or night by simply making the sound of the bumblebee. And I don't necessarily shower every day. We live in California. It's a drought. But I often will take a sponge bath, and so, you know, with a little washcloth or something. So I like to clean my psychic collar then separately using this technique, and so this would be another little homework assignment that I'd like to give. And what you do is you just put your upper and lower front teeth together lightly, very lightly, and then barely touching those teeth, you make the Z sound. Yeah. And you just let a little vibration arise. And just know that any thoughts or images that are not yours will sort of vibrate right off. They'll just simply dissolve. So let's try it one more time. Yeah, that's nice. Thank you. So enjoy that exercise this week. Maybe every day, if you get a chance.
Well, thank you so much for that, Josephine. Yeah, I did have, I saw myself behaving in a particular way earlier in the day, and I thought, that's my dad in me.
Very good.
It was just like a flashback to my childhood, and it's kind of like, oh, yeah.
But now back to the archetypes. You know, it's. I think that the archetypes can also really help us to know ourselves better. I remember one time in one of our women's circles, we went through and studied a little bit of the goddesses and every woman in Jean Shinoda Bowen's book, and we looked up who we most closely aligned with, and then we dressed as that goddess and came to the group and then discussed it a little bit and talked about why that was so near and dear to us. And so, you know, these are all ways that we can get to know ourselves better, and as we, you know ourselves better, that helps us to reach for a more full expression of our true self in our lives. And then also, back to the idea of, you know, how these can have these other thoughts of other people, and also how the archetypes can have an influence on us, you know, just by the sheer weight of numbers of people who have come and gone in these group mind patterns. You know, as I mentioned, this can be kind of like a river, and they can be very influential. Carl Jung advised that we become conscious of the archetypes so that we can be aware of them, either use their energy or free ourselves from it a little bit instead of being swept up by them. And you've got that slide there, Tony. Maybe you can show that.
Certainly.
And this one says, what we do not make conscious emerges later as fate. And I think that, you know, we just want to be aware of what is going on. So if we're conscious of it, then it doesn't necessarily become our fate. But if we are sort of innocently being swept along by it, well, then it might become so. And then also, we can meet our archetypes in our nighttime dreams. I know I've had many a dream where I've had these archetypal images appear. And we can use them to guide us if that feels right when we're doing our dream interpretation. And we can also encounter them in daydreams. You know, some time ago I read a Psychology Today article on daydreaming, which had a lot of nice points on daydreaming. And, you know, daydreams are like dreams of the self. They can be roadmaps for our future. And what I've noticed is that daydreams are a very creative tool that we can use with our free will as we're choosing what we'd love in our lives. And daydreams can open us to our right brain function of allowing new and novel solutions to our problems to occur. And, you know, of course, naturally, and rather sadly, usually teachers and parents and employers generally discourage daydreaming, but it can actually be a very beneficial thing for manifesting the success of our future focus. And they've even done studies of school children where they've asked them to muse on their academic successes, and it actually has it really increases their chances, like something like 90%, I forget what it was now, but it was some huge percentage of making it more possible that those children will actually accomplish those goals or those ideas. So, you know, daydreaming really lets us sort of plot out our future, and it gives us time to reflect and imagine. It's sort of like the golfer who walks the golf course before a big game. You know, our daydreams can really let us see the outcome that, you know, we would love to have and that we desire. And we can pretend through the daydreams that it's so. It just is part of that creative process. So some people actually refer to daydreaming as autobiographical planning, which I think is a really great term. And then one of my favorite comedians, Stephen Wright, says, "I was trying to daydream, but my mind kept wandering." and, you know, when we daydream, we in part let go of the present moment and slip into these little private experiences of self-amusement. And there's lots of different types of daydreams. You know, some of them are slightly unpleasant. You know, we might have the sort of the suffering martyr daydream or the conquering hero idea or the guilt or the failure scenarios. But there are also those positive, constructive ones that really help us to experience good psychological health with happiness and positive emotions. So I think it's a great idea to encourage ourselves to go ahead and do as much daydreaming as possible. And then also paying attention to our daydreams is one of the ways that we can better know ourselves. You know, it's a way that we can engage in the yoga of the watching bird, you know, the being the witness or the observer of our thoughts, you know, to which we do indeed create our lives with. And there's that founder of American psychology, William James, who, when he was accused of being absent-minded, he said, oh, maybe you can put the slide on, Tony.
Certainly.
He said, "No, I'm really present-minded to my own thoughts." And I think that's so great, because that's what's happening, you know, when we are, quote, absent-minded, is we're just not paying attention to other people and things that are going on around necessarily, but we might be really deep in our thoughts, you know. I think of Albert Einstein sometimes, you know, going to work with only one sock on, you know. Clearly he had some things going on upstairs that were more important.
Yeah, I was very much like that as a child.
Were you?
This is very good. I mean, I think, and that's why for me the show we did recently about going out to nature is so important, because
yeah,
there it's so much easier to daydream and to be present-minded to your own thoughts, whereas I find that, you know, there's a lot of distractions. You know, especially since the arrival of the internet.
Yes, oh my gosh, yes. The Electro Frank had a comic that he put up on the refrigerator not too long ago that had all these people waiting in a subway, and they all had little lines going down. They were all plugged into the electricity of the railroad tracks or something.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had a laptop or a cell phone or something going on, and there's a lot of distractions definitely in the
mm-hmm.
electronic world. But there's also plenty of time for us to enjoy our daydreams. You know, other means of, and some of these other means of plotting the course of our lives. And it's a good idea for us to do so. So, you know, coffee breaks at work, you know, that's a wonderful time to step outside and just let yourself slip into a little musing or window gazing. That's always been one of my specialties. As a child, I don't think I could have survived in a classroom without windows. And then, you know, listening within and going within, you know, these are all great. And then, of course, watching for synchronicities. That's one of the things about that hero's journey that I was talking about earlier. When we are on the path of our life, even if it's not a heroic path, because sometimes our lives can be very simple with these things, but synchronicities will occur, and that's when we know we're headed in the right direction. Some people call them meaningful coincidences. Another thing that is really beneficial is little meditation breaks. So like some of these exercises that I've mentioned tonight, you know, these are great ways for us to let our true lives sort of begin to come before us. Just kicking all the thoughts of others out of our heads from time to time is great. Or sitting out in the car, you know, I'll go out there and sit. It's nice and warm out there sometimes. I'm all alone. When I was a young person, I used to go sit in this one stairway that we had that had a door top and bottom. I was all alone in there. I could just be alone with my thoughts. Or I would sometimes go out to the corral with the horse or slip into the bushes or look at the sky or watch the birds or take a short walk to the city park. It's all good.
Oh, something that I've found recently that if I have to drive over to Arroyo Grande, that's what,
I don't know,
15 miles, is it, 20 miles from where we are, a few times a week. And if I just go 5 or 10 minutes earlier than I need to, I can stop at Shell Beach and there's a lovely bench overlooking the cliffs and the ocean. And just take 5 minutes just to, you know, as we were talking about earlier, push out the thoughts of others and just spend a little bit of time with my own thoughts and daydream. And that's been really helpful.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. And, you know, that is one of the things about some of these long commutes. They can be wonderful times for self-reflection. So there's another little part to all of this, which is the fairy stories, those fairy tales. They're just such wonderful things for us. And they can really offer a lot of guidance and consolation. And they sometimes speak to a really deep part of ourselves. There's one fairy story that comes up for me from time to time, and it has this famous line in it. So the guy is riding along the forest path, and he's on his horse, and he sees this beautiful feather laying down there on the pathway, and he thinks to himself, oh my gosh, he was on the way to the city to, you know, where the king was. If I could get, if I bring that feather to the king, you know, I'll get great favor. And so he hops off his horse and he bends down to pick up the feather. And right then the horse turns to him and says, don't pick up that feather. And, you know, the guy didn't know his horse was a talking horse, but there he is. He's like, what? What do you mean? You know, don't pick up that feather or you will regret it. And, of course, the fairy story goes on where he takes it to the king and the king says, great feather, now where's the bird? You know, go get it or I'll have your head. And, you know, if you could bring me the bird, you can have my daughter, but otherwise, you know, deal's off and you're dead. And so, you know, and then there's another fairy story where there's the taskmaster sets the young man to this incredible task and he has got to do something with all these sticks and he does it the whole thing. It takes him all night and he has assistants. These, you know, fairies come and help him. And in the morning there's the one stick left that he didn't get and the taskmaster comes in and she says, ha ha, you know, you didn't do it good enough. Here's the stick. And he picks it up and after she turns away, he picks it up and throws it at her. Sometimes there's things that can speak to us in these stories, and we don't really know what exactly it is that it's trying to communicate, but there's something on a deep level. And, you know, these stories are pretty amazing and wonderful. Usually there's a wedding at the end or some sort of resolve, and they all live happily ever after. But I remember my young niece, Julia, when she was a little girl, we would tell her a story, and a lot of times right when we would finish, she would say, again. She would want to hear it again and again and again. And that's because there's something for us there. And there's that wonderful quote that I think it's by Muriel Rukeyser, the American poet and activist. And she said, the universe is made up of stories, not atoms.
Mm.
Isn't that a great one?
Yeah.
And if we're requesting repetition of a story like that, there's something there for us, some clue, some assistance. And so we do. We want to listen to it again and again, and it feeds our soul. And our favorite stories are very important for us, so we really want to drink deeply at that river and often. And let your sixth sense open up to receive. It's a good thing to do.
Oh, that's such wonderful. I'm thinking of my favorite stories as you were talking about that. And I just wanted to say just a tiny bit, you know, going back to when that period when I was studying the Greek and the Roman myths, I was also studying fairy tales, as you mentioned them, and I was introduced to a woman called Marie-Louise von France, and she was a very close friend of Carl Jung's and a colleague. They worked together for many years on mythology and fairy tales. And she wrote extensively, and I read many of her books about fairy tales. And I think it's probably safe to say she's perhaps the world's greatest authority on the psychological meaning of fairy tales. I don't think anyone explored it more or wrote as many books. And they were truly fascinating and enlightening. And I have a quote here. I don't know what you'll make of it. She wrote, "I've come to the conclusion that all fairy tales endeavor to describe one and the same psychic fact, but a fact so complex and far-reaching and so difficult for us to realize in all its different aspects that hundreds of tales and thousands of repetitions with a musician's variation are needed until this unknown fact is delivered into consciousness. And even then, the theme is not exhausted. This unknown fact is the self, which is the psychic reality of the collective unconscious. Every archetype is, in its essence, only one aspect of the collective unconscious, as well as always representing also the whole collective unconscious."
Oh, that's great. Wow. How do you spell her name?
It's just Marie, M-A-R-I-E, then a hyphen, Louise, just, and then Von, V-O-N, and then France, F-R-A-N-Z.
Wow, she sounds like a wonderful author to read.
Yes, and really interested in psychic phenomena as well. I remember reading some things that she wrote about that. Probably, you know, some of the things that Jung was very interested in but didn't write about so much.
God, she sounds like a great person to read. I'm going to have to look her up.
Yeah, I mean, just for, you know, the everyday fairy tales like, you know, Cinderella and Rapunzel and Hansel and Gretel and, you know, all the ones that we tend to hear in childhood, really rich insights into, you know, what they could mean for us.
And I love that idea that it's really talking to an aspect of the collective unconscious.
Yeah, and a way in through the fairy, each and every fairy tale, a different way in to get down to the deep self.
Oh, that's so true. That's just really great. Yeah, and these stories, they really call to us, and they hold some sort of magical key to the door of our lives. So I always like to suggest that we read to each other and to our children. And, you know, Frank reads to me every night, and it opens me up to that imaginative, creative, spacious aspect of myself that lets me flow so nicely into my dreams, and I wake up with a lot of ideas from those, you know, being exposed to these wonderful stories and images and ideas. And these fairy stories, they really help us to wrap our minds around the inner knowledge of ourselves, around whatever it is that's captivating our attention. And then there's one last point that I want to make on this, that it's that a deeply satisfying life that's rich with inner peace and a sense that all is right with the world does not necessarily always have to be heroic. You know, Peace Pilgrim tells this wonderful story of a woman who, she wasn't quite sure what her purpose was in life, and she said, you know, Peace said, "Well, what do you love?" And she said, "Well, I love to swim," you know, but she wasn't quite good enough to be, you know, a competitive swimmer. And then she also loved picking flowers and gardening and arranging flowers. That just really thrilled her no end. She really enjoyed that. And then she also loved playing the piano. But again, she wasn't good enough to be a concert pianist or anything like that. So Peace said, "Well, why don't you, you know, see if you can get a job?" And Peace sort of helped her to find this job at a local flower shop arranging flowers. And so that became her livelihood. And then she loved the swimming, and that's what she did for exercise, to get out and move her body every day. And then for the piano, she started going down and playing the show tunes at the old folks' home. And that really created this beautiful life that was a simple life, but very rich with satisfaction and inner peace and a sense that all was right with the world. So I just wanted to mention that. And then also, too, Peace Pilgrim says, and maybe you can show our slide there.
Certainly.
She says, "Do all of the good things that you are motivated to do, even if they are only little good things, and give these first priority in your life over all of the ordinary and mundane things that customarily clutter our human lives." And I think that's such wise advice. You know, just do, even if it's little things, just do what feels like you're motivated to do, and let those come to the forefront of our lives. And that is the golden key, the golden road to really take us into the lives that we love.
Thank you so much for that, for that, Josephine. I'm certainly going to take that to heart. But unfortunately, I do have to say that it's almost time for us to go. So the link to next week's show can be found on Josephine's website at stepintomagic.com. Simply click on the top menu for radio. And if you have a question or would like to be included in our weekly newsletter, simply go to the contact page of Josephine's website. Again, that's stepintomagic.com. So, Josephine, are there any parting words that you'd like to say?
Well, yes, there are. I'd just like to reiterate tonight our three main points, which first, you know, sometimes the passions of our life will sweep us up into a hero's journey, and we just want to remember to choose what we love, and that might result in a much more simple expression of a life well lived, like the example that I just spoke of. And then second, archetypes can really influence our lives both positively or negatively, so we just want to be aware of them. And same with the telepathic thoughts, you know. So if it, and also, so just to remember, if it's a positive influence, we can embrace that assistance, you know. Or if it's, you know, maybe it's not so positive, then we can use our intention to diminish that effect. And then third, you know, sparking our imagination through daydreams or fairy stories can help us to find our role in life and to create the roadmap to get there. So in closing, I'd like to share this little blessing, which again was a gift from my friend and mentor and teacher, Jana Massey, and it goes like this. As our gifts are given in love, they are received in love, and we honor their wise use and their increase for all concerned. And thank you so much for the gift of your time.
Thank you so much for that, Josephine. It's been a pleasure speaking with you this evening, and I trust that everyone listening has learned about and has enjoyed myths, archetypes, and daydreams guide us on our journey. This has been show number PJ-3.15. And if you'd like to join our email list, please just send us a message by the box on the left-hand side of your screen, or go to Josephine's website and visit the contact page. And we keep all of our emails confidential. And if you've enjoyed the show, we really hope that you will tell your friends. So we look forward to having all of you join us again next week when Josephine will be exploring astrology and numerology as guideposts for our soul growth.
Yes, and please do tell your friends. I love word of mouth. I think it's always the best way. So Tony and I wish you all insight, wisdom, and magic as you pursue the journey of inner knowing. And I hold you all in light and in love. Thank you so very much for listening. This is Josephine Lang. Until next week, good night.